This is a speech by the leader of the Canadian Green Party, Elizabeth May, given on November 22, 2008, in Victoria, British Columbia. She is introduced by the deputy leader of the Green Party, Adrian Carr. The occasion was the launch of Elizabeth May and Zoe Caron's new book, Global Warming for Dummies. The speech was recorded from a laptop computer by Janine Bancroft of Victoria.
Tell you the time will come. We will have those safe seats. Elizabeth will be elected as the leader of the Green Party of Canada because I think people really are on that verge of waking up. And she is a remarkable person. So it is my pleasure to introduce her. And just to remind you, sometimes we forget, you know, a woman who has written 6 books, including How to Save the Planet in Your Spare Time, of which she has none, and her latest co-authored with Zoe Caron, Global Warming for Dummies, but presented to, of course, geniuses in the audience, and of course, written by geniuses, holder of 3 honorary doctorates, a woman's chair in health and environment named in her name at Dalhousie University, having sat on the boards of phenomenal international institutions, Earth Charter International, International Institute for Sustainable Development, and there are others, Officer of the Order of Canada, and John Fryer, are you not also in the Order of Canada, John? You know, prestigious group we have here. And the woman elected to leadership of the Green Party of Canada, who led this party to its most successful election ever. The woman who got us into the debates and really did, by the pundits, win those debates, French and English. In this last election that actually tangibly increased our vote, going up, the other parties may have had a few percentage increases in some cases, but not increased votes. 270,000 votes more, almost 1 million Canadians voting Green. 41 of our candidates achieving over 10%, a record number over 10%. Congratulations again to John, to Adam Staff for breaking that 10%. It's really good for the money, but it's just great for the morale as well. A fabulous tour, an innovative, brilliant idea to take the train across Canada, lowest carbon emission leaders tour, bar none, by far, across Canada. Personally achieving the highest vote of any Green Party candidate who has run nationally ever. 32% of the vote in her riding. So please join me in welcoming Elizabeth. Brian and Adam and John, Adrian, and I particularly want to note to say how thrilled I am to see, and it is of course the case, and I've made the case very often as Vision Green makes the case, that the part of government that most Canadians are closest to, the part of government that delivers real services, I sometimes say, you know, how would you know if your federal government went on strike? When they forgot to ask you for your taxes? Whereas if your municipal government goes on strike, you notice very quickly because your recycling isn't picked up and your garbage is there and what's happening to water services. So municipalities across this country, municipal governments, are in many ways the grassroots party, I'm happy to acknowledge that working in a municipal level government is where the action is, it's where things really happen, and I'm extremely pleased to have 25% of Victoria Council populated by Greens. And I'm particularly thrilled to know that both Philippe and Mary over there, their baby girl, Sophie, was born in the middle of the campaign, September 27th. So that's something to be celebrated. And of course, you did meet Sonia's daughter, Penelope, earlier. And Sonia, are you still in here?
But, Penelope.
She can Penelope. Well, the book I haven't written yet, but always wanted to write, was called Half Baby Will Travel. And my podium with me. I took her with me everywhere from when our first meeting after she was born, she was 14 days old. And I was executive director of Sierra Club, and I had a call from the federal minister of parks had come into the Sierra Club office, a request to meet with me to discuss some parks issues. And I didn't get maternity leave. That's another story about being self-employed and working in the environmental movement. That's okay. So when she was 13 days old, I got this call that the minister of parks wanted to meet with me the next day. So I thought about it for about 30 seconds and said, well, tell her that if she doesn't mind if I bring a 14-day-old baby to the meeting, we're set. So that was kind of the excuse to actually get up, shower, and put on clothes again, and take my baby down with my stepson's girlfriend, who was living with us at the time, to act as nanny, and meet with the Minister for Parks. Now, this worked extremely well. That was the moment that I discovered that babies are the best lobbying trip of all. And instead of going in hat in hand to ask the minister for something, she had this little blue Birks box with a little baby gift for me, and the whole meeting was lovely. And anyway, so my book that I now have, I mentioned I had a stepson. I have two stepdaughters, a stepson, all adults and with partners and with kids. So I have seven grandchildren. I woke up this morning in Vancouver with the one-year-old and the three-year-old on top of me. And this book is dedicated to my children and my grandchildren in the hopes that by the time the youngest of you is old enough to read this book, the prognosis will be very different and far more hopeful. So this is the focus that we have to keep at all times. I'm very, very thrilled to see that Penelope is here and Sophie is here, and this is why we're doing this. As we all know as Greens, this isn't about us, and it's not about political power for its own sake. It's very directly about what we need to do for our own children and grandchildren. So this book is there. I want to give you a quick synopsis of what you'll find in the book, and then I want to abridge a long lecture into an opportunity to exchange with you. Because you're very keen, I can tell from the applause that's gone forward that you were involved and helpful and committed in the last election campaign. There may be other things you want to hear from me besides what we're doing with Global Warming for Dummies, but I'll tell you about it first. First, you need to know that Adrian mentioned my co-author, Zoe Caron. She's from British Columbia. She's a young climate activist. I'll be seeing her next when we both get to Poland next month. We're going to the United Nations 14th Conference of the Parties. It's the first time I've gone at since I became leader of the Green Party. I thought in last December's meeting in Bali that there wasn't a particularly strong reason for me to attend, given the distance to go in Bali and the fact that the Canadian media seem to be paying a bit of attention. But as you know, I'll talk more about Canadian politics in a moment, but with the new Minister of Environment now, Jim Prentice, I don't hold out a whole lot of hope that the instructions top down, and this is a very, very top down government, will change substantially. But I want to be there to see what can be done and how to report back to Canadians and back to Canadian Greens. And now that I legitimately represent nearly 1 million Canadians who wanted our policies put forward, if we could certainly make the case very strongly for proportional representation. But when I'm talking to Canadian government officials, when I'm in the parliament, in my seat, just in the diplomatic gallery during question period, I'm there on behalf of a much larger constituency. And back to Adrian's point, I don't know how many of you know that actually the Harper Conservatives in this election got 170,000 fewer votes than in 2006. We got 270,000 more. On the Liberals got about 800,000 fewer votes. The NDP got fewer votes, but that low voter turnout allowed their percentages to have bumped up a bit, but still not much. It was all about how they targeted certain ridings, and the conservative messages were very much targeted around certain ridings, as opposed to becoming popular with the vast majority of Canadians. Because if they wanted to do that, they would move on the issue that I want to talk about. Now you can well imagine that in the lead up to an election and not knowing when one would be and knowing that the book was nearly going to be hitting the store shelves, I very much hoped that it would be available for the election so I could hold it up on occasion, like at the debates, and say, I wrote this for you. That didn't happen. I didn't have the book ready until after. And the reason I called this lecture today, Global Warming for Dummies and Geniuses, is that obviously I didn't pick I didn't pick anything with this title. For one thing, I wanted to call it the climate crisis, because I don't think global warming is the right terminology. You end up having people saying, what do you mean global warming every time there's a snowstorm? It's cold. It's gotten cold. If sometimes it gets cold, but climate crisis is the right terminology. But then again, I was writing for dummies, and the dummies editors immediately said, no, most of our books are going to be sold in the U.S. This, by the way, is being distributed simultaneously for the whole English-speaking world. This is Canada, the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and it's being translated into other languages. So global warming for dummies it is. But that doesn't mean that I think the people who may not be certain about science are dummies. Most of you, I think, will know that this yellow-covered format of books for dummies is a series that has, if not thousands, at least many hundreds of different titles available. And as a result, it may be the thing I've written, it will be the thing I've written, that reaches more people and may do more good. But the process of trying to take the science from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and condense it, it's even more condensed and more designed for the everyman, if you will, or every person, even than Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. It went through a tremendous process of being reduced to its most clear elements, so that there was very, I hope, there's no room for anyone to be unable to follow the arguments of what's happening and why it matters. So where we are on the planet right now, I think given the nature of this audience and your commitment to green issues, I don't need to start from the basics of the climate crisis and what we're facing. But we are at a point where, and this book I hope will put to bed for many people the notion that there's a big scientific controversy out there and that anyone's really at any doubt at the scientific level of what's happening. We know that we've already changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. We've done that through burning fossil fuels. We've swamped the global systems of carbon balance. The helpful effects of all of the green and leafy things on this planet and the soils and the oceans that pull carbon out of the atmosphere and release oxygen. So that effect basically, all of our grade 3 photosynthesis comes back to understand the climate crisis. We have a system that has worked over many, many millennia that's held the carbon in the atmosphere more or less in balance. There's certainly been times, such as during ice ages, when the CO2 in the atmosphere has dropped. But there's never been a time in the last 800,000 years when carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have been as high as they now are. Now that's sobering. And that's all happened since the Industrial Revolution, since the discovery of fossil fuels, which are, of course, the fossilized remains of those things that were once green, leafy things that were pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and producing oxygen. So the fossilized organic material from the forests millions of years ago, even before the time the dinosaurs compressed in some areas as coal, in others as natural gas, in others as oil, all of which are being discovered in one huge burst, essentially, in cosmic global terms, in terms of the planet's life of 3.5 billion years of life on planet Earth, there has never been such a pulse of carbon to the atmosphere. And it's because we're grabbing it, digging it up, and burning it as fast as we can. That pulse of carbon to the atmosphere, as I said, has swamped the systems that sequester carbon and has allowed the concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere to change. And that's what I mean when I say we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. I really think that the climate crisis is better understood as an issue of chemistry than of temperature. You can talk to people about how global average temperatures are going up, and you probably have this experience if you've talked to neighbors or contrarian uncles in the family who say, well, and how did they know what temperature it was even 500 years ago, but what about 2,000 years? How would they know what temperature it was? So you can get these temperature arguments, and the temperature data from the international scientific community is really good, but it is in the order of called proxy data, because no one's actually taking temperatures then. You have to go back over fossilized records. You can use pollen, you can use snail shells, you can use all kinds of things to get the proxy data of the temperature going back through time. The chemistry going back through time, on the other hand, is empirical, modern data, and that's what's really cool about the science around this issue. The empirical modern data of the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere 1,000 years ago is available to us. And And that's because of the amazing scientific work done in Antarctic ice core work. The Antarctic ice cores that you see drilled and discussed, and we also review movies in dummies because it's important to have some flipper ship areas that are light reading, hard to do in a book about global warming and climate crisis. But we remind people of the movie the Day After Tomorrow. How many of you saw that just for fun? Okay, well, you remember the opening scene when Dennis Quaid nearly falls into that chasm as the ice? But that was they never explained what he was doing there. But of course, they were drilling Antarctic ice cores. And as they take the ice cores away, they measure exactly when that ice was formed. And when you know when the ice was formed, every air pocket in the ice core is essentially a time capsule. It tells you what the atmosphere was like when the ice formed. It tells you exactly what, because it is a time capsule of the atmosphere from when the ice was formed. And that's how we know with certainty that the level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere up until the Industrial Revolution never went above 280 parts per million. A vanishingly small amount of CO2 considering the entirety of an atmosphere, but 280 parts per million is as high as it ever went, going back not just 500 years or 2,000 years. Sometimes big numbers like 800,000 years ago, you need to stop and put a frame of reference. Well, Christ walked the earth 2,000 years ago. Let's go to ancient Greece. Well, now we'll go back to the dawn of civilization, go back before that. Go back to before there were humans on the planet. When you go back 800,000 years, that's a very long record in the lifespan of a planet. And we have pushed carbon above what it has been in that entire period. So humans have never lived on the planet when CO2 was as high as it now is. And the global climate systems are responding to this heat signal because CO2 is one of the very powerful greenhouse gases that, by the way, in their natural state, natural greenhouse effect, is entirely beneficial. If we did not have it, as most of you know, this planet would be too cold to sustain life at all. So the presence of carbon dioxide in our environment has been entirely beneficial. But as we as humans have interfered with the climate system, we've thrown it all out of whack. So with CO2 now at about 384 parts per million, we're adding about 2 parts per million a year, scientists are becoming extremely alarmed because we're pushing the climate into areas where we could hit tipping points, sometimes referred to as points of no return, in global climate systems, where nothing we would do in the future would make any difference. And that's the level at which we now find ourselves. When I first started working on the issue of climate change, it was, more than 20 years ago. So 22 years ago, I went to work in the office of the Federal Minister of Environment. I was a grassroots anti-pesticide activist and anti-nuclear activist, and I had no thought that I'd ever go work in the office of a federal minister of environment. That's another story. I found myself there. That's when I first got to know Adrian and Paul and a lot of people in this community because I was in charge of all the files of what needed to be done in that office that was about the environment, and everybody else worked on the politics because I wasn't a conservative. They didn't want me anywhere near the politics. I just worked on saving the environment, which is a pretty good deal. So I got to know a lot of my friends in this room from the South Moresby fight. But climate change wasn't on my mind when I went to work for the Federal Minister of Environment. But the Environment Canada scientists were the one who educated me on the climate crisis because I was in all the briefings with the minister. And the picture that was being painted was really frightening, and I immediately could see what we were working on acid rain at the time. We were also working on ozone depletion at the time. But the climate crisis was gaining steadily, in my mind, as the thing we had to be most worried about once we could make sure we had an ozone layer. And that science was based on modeling that was far less sophisticated than what we now have. Yet the scientists at Environment Canada were saying, you know, we could see retreating glaciers, we could see the shrinking of the Arctic ice cap, we'll see sea level rise. We may begin to see these things as early as 2030. Things are happening far faster than I ever imagined, what the scientists were imagining back in 1986. So in having worked on this issue for this amount of time, the reason that scientists are sounding increasingly alarmed is that what's happening is happening faster than the modeling and the climate science that we had 22 years ago suggested. And that's because we see looming closer and closer these tipping points, these points of no return. The reason that things are happening faster than we expected, well, it's really twofold. One is that even in the last 20 years, our use of fossil fuels and the rates of emissions of greenhouse gases has continued to rise. The rise of an industrial base in China, for example, the expansion of the tar sands is the main reason that Canada hasn't reached its target for Kyoto at all and hasn't brought down emissions, but seen them rise more rapidly since we signed Kyoto than before it. That's one piece of it. But the larger element is really that scientists in the modeling and in the projections haven't taken into account the effect of positive feedback loops. Now, positive feedback loops, I'm sure a lot of you are aware of them. Certainly, if you've seen Al Gore's movie, you've seen a bunch of them. The Arctic ice, for instance, when the ice cap has a nice, solid, you know, many thousand square miles, thousands of kilometers of ice at the top of the world, that white ice bounces off the sun's radiative heat. So as it strikes the Earth, most of it bounces away. And as the ocean water warms, coming up from other areas of the planet on the conveyor belts of the oceans, as that ocean water is warmer coming up from the Pacific, begins to melt the ice. As the ice begins to melt, it opens and exposes more dark ocean water. So you lose what's called the albedo effect of sun striking white ice and bouncing away. And you have more dark ocean water, and dark things absorb heat. It's not just a fashion statement. Why we wear white in summer and dark clothes in winter. Dark clothes keep us warmer, and white clothes keep us cooler. Well, same thing for the planet. So as the dark ocean water is exposed, more of the sun's radiative heat sinks in and is absorbed, warming the ocean faster, melting the ice faster, exposing more dark water to soak up more heat faster, to melt more ice faster. That's why it's going so fast that people can barely keep up with it. Same thing with melting permafrost. It's another one of the positive feedback loops. Permafrost is, of course, frozen organic material. It's largely frozen peat. It also was, of course, a place that carbon was sequestered, and particularly in the form of methane. So as the permafrost melts, it releases vast quantities of methane, and methane then pulses to the atmosphere to cause more warming, to cause more melting, warming, etc. Another one that's very easy to anticipate is that as forests get drier and drier and burn more, the forests that are burning release more CO2, and that, of course, goes to the atmosphere to cause more warming. The one that's, of course, a very local example, huge, and in terms of economic impact, the biggest climate disaster thus far in Canada is the loss of the interior British Columbia forest that was lodgepole pine, where the pine beetle used to be kept in check by very cold winter weather. And a cold snap in winter would hold the pine beetle down. And once the pine beetle had no check in the winter, as you know, the epidemic reached proportions that were completely unprecedented. And an area the size of two Swedens is gone, and that dead forest, as it decomposes, is pulsing carbon to the atmosphere. Now, as early as 1984, the government of Canada scientists announced that Canada's forests had ceased to be a net sink for carbon and had become a net source of carbon. And that was a couple decades back. We saw that transition from increased insect epidemics, increased forest fires. But the pine beetle outbreak and what's happening to the dead forests that were lodgepole pine now is potentially, based on the scientific modeling, it's awful hard to really even imagine that this is true, but the evidence is that the pulsing carbon from the interior dead lodgepole pine forests will be a larger pulse of carbon than all of BC's industries. Now that's called a positive feedback loop. There's nothing positive about it. So as more of these accelerate, there'll be a point at which, even if it went cold turkey, and unplugged ourselves from our addiction to fossil fuels overnight, would cease to make any difference because we would have unleashed too many of these accelerating global systems that continue to intensify a warming trend. this why, you know, basically, whenever I hear Stephen Harper talk about how his targets for climate change are quote-unquote realistic, it makes me livid because, number one, his plan involves intensity targets, which mean that you don't actually have absolute caps on the amount of carbon being released. You just have a commitment to have less per unit of production, so that every barrel of oil out of the Athabasca tar sands will produce less carbon. And the other part of course, the plan is to vastly increase the barrels of oil coming out of the tar sands, so your emissions are going up while you're meeting your targets. But leaving that aside, the idea that a target for greenhouse gas reductions is a political construct, that a government could come in and say, well, we don't like the targets that are in the Kyoto Protocol. We don't like the targets that are coming from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We're going to pick a realistic target. You know, the atmosphere is not the least bit interested in negotiating with humanity. Not the least bit interested. We have no bargaining power here. We merely have a little window, and we still have that window. And we have this window in which we can take the actions needed to hold the level of climate change to which we're now committed. So we can't go back. We can't say, well, we're sorry we changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. Oh, Lord, please forgive us for our sins, and now we're going to make it go back, please. We could pray very hard. I do suggest we do that. But in the meantime, we can't make it go back. We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. So the question is, how can we ensure that the new CO2 level in our atmosphere, the new level of CO2 that stays with us more or less permanently, is held low enough that we can survive the impacts? So seeking a new CO2 equilibrium in the atmosphere, a concentration level will become more or less stable. We're still going to see lots of effects over time, even if we were to hold it where we are right now. And just to give you a bit of a frame of reference in terms of lifetimes, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, and we go into a lot of detail in the book, when it was formed and how it was formed, but it's essentially the top scientists selected by governments to report to policymakers through a United Nations agency. It was created in 1988. It's been taking complicated science and advising governments ever since. That's its job. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change releases a summary report every few years. The one that was released, the penultimate one, the one just about 2 years ago, their report number 3, made it clear that if we were to reduce CO2 immediately and to levels that were 60% below 1990 levels, we would see the new level of CO2 stabilize in about 100 years. We would see global average temperature increases level off in a little more than 100 years. And we would see sea level rise that was put in motion by our actions today. We'd see sea level rise arrested in 1,000 years. So the atmosphere doesn't turn on a dime. Now, of course, the level at which that sea level rise would be arrested in 1,000 years would be about 1 meter sea level rise. If we keep going in the direction we're going, for instance, some of those tipping points events are in the category of abrupt climate change. So what kinds of things would we do that would create an abrupt climate change scenario? Because that's another thing we kind of hold in our head is this idea, especially I think we call it global warming, but this sort of nice, steady, it's worrying for future generations, but it just kind of creeps along incrementally, a little bit warmer every year, slightly more pleasant afternoons like today, every year, and eventually it'll get, you know, some bad storms. We understand that, some occasional bad storms. But the notion of an abrupt shock to the whole global climate system from hitting a tipping point is something that doesn't get discussed very much in the national media. One of the climate scientists, who actually, speaking of media, was actually quoted right after Hurricane Katrina in Newsweek magazine. He said, you know, we may have to start understanding climate change less as a dial and more as a switch. That we can hit some very abrupt things. So the ones that are talked about the most that we describe in the book would be, for instance, if the Gulf Stream stopped. Now the Gulf Stream is affected by the melting ice from the Arctic, because the melting Arctic water is fresh water, And the thing that moves the current along in the Gulf Stream and the friction between air temperature, salinity in the water, the salinity, of course, saltier water is heavier than fresh water. So as there's more fresh water entering the Gulf Stream current, it's slowing it down. Over the last number of decades, the Gulf Stream is now 30% slower than it used to be. And if it were to stop altogether, which an abrupt climate change effect would be at a high level of risk if we allow CO2 levels to reach 425 parts per million, bearing in mind we're now at 384 and we were never above 280 before. So that's not that far off in our future if we don't reduce greenhouse gases rapidly. The abrupt stop of the Gulf Stream would, of course, speaking to my point about global warming being perhaps a misleading term, all of Europe would get much colder much faster. Those of you who grew up in England, and I know Daphne did, and probably some others of you here, whoever John did, England doesn't have the same climate as Canada, even though it's largely in the same part of latitudes. Well, that's because of the Gulf Stream. And if the Gulf Stream goes, the first effect is a real shock to those parts of Europe that were used to a climate that wasn't as cold. But the knock-on effects, it's like a domino effect right around the planet. Places that used to have enough rain to grow crops will lose that rainfall. Places that used to be breadbaskets will become deserts. Just keep spiraling it around the world. And you see a massive effect in terms of dislocation of millions of people, environmental refugee problems, famine, and so on. So there's also the social and economic dislocation that knocks on from a really abrupt climate shift. The other two big ones, and I'll accelerate this so I can take some questions, but the other two big ones would be what happens if we lose the Western Antarctic ice sheet, which is enormous. It's 3.2 million square kilometers of ice. That's a new measure. We try to think about it. A cubic kilometer of ice. So 3.2 million cubic kilometers of ice. If we lose the Western Antarctic ice sheet, it's not as the Arctic ice is. Sitting on land and melting. It's not sitting on water melting. If you have a glass of water and an ice cube melts in it, the water doesn't overflow the top of the glass. But if you have ice sitting on a landmass that's melting, it dislocates. It displaces the ocean's water. So the loss of the Western Antarctic ice sheet would move the IPCC estimates for sea level rise from 1 meter sea level rise to 4 to 5 meters sea level rise. So we lose every coastal city on the planet. The same thing will happen if we lose the Greenland ice sheet, which is melting very rapidly from warm water displacing it at its base. The Greenland ice sheet would also have the effect of increasing sea level rise by 4 to 5 meters. So these are the scale of events that become at a high level of risk if we don't ensure that greenhouse gas levels are reduced fast. How fast and by how much? Well, the best science I can find, and we certainly look, the IPCC is providing good information, obviously, but also the World Environment and World Energy Outlook of the International Energy Agency. And it's the International Energy Agency that I'll quote now. They say that to avoid those tipping points, those points of no return, and this also comes from a lot of other science, we know we don't want to see CO2 levels go to 425 parts per million or above, because at that point, we're stuck with a 2-degree average global temperature increase. If it goes above that, say at 3 degrees, you're absolutely committed to 4 degrees. 4 degrees to 5, 5 to 6, 6 to 7, 7 to 8 is just a way to arrest that growth in rapid temperature change on planet Earth. And by the way, I left out a little frame of reference point for you, because whenever we talk about global average temperature increases of 1 degree Celsius, I know a lot of people find that underwhelming in a country that goes from minus 20 or minus 30 in the winter to plus 30 in the summer. But the difference in global average temperatures between life on Earth now and life on Earth in the last ice age is 5 degrees. So there's these numbers, very small numbers, contain huge levels of change because averages contain a lot of extremes. So for global average temperature to stay at around 2 degrees Celsius and not go above that, we need to ensure that the greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere stay at carbon dioxide equivalents of around 400 to 425 parts per million and no more. As I mentioned earlier, at current rates of fossil fuel release and burning of fossil fuels and destruction of forests, that's another piece to the climate change problem, is loss of forests and other sinks. But at current rates, we're at about 2 parts per million a year. So basically, looking at those kinds of projections going forward, the International Energy Agency says that to avoid passing points of no return in the global atmosphere, we must globally, all countries, all emitters, ensure that the year 2015 is the last year in which greenhouse gases continue to go up. So they must peak no later than 2015, start coming down from there. That's boss, right? The atmosphere is not interested in negotiating with humanity, that's it. So we need to ensure that everybody begins bringing down greenhouse gases. Now the good news is, not by 60% by 2017, just stop the rise in greenhouse gases, hold it so it doesn't go any higher by 2015, and starts the process of coming down. Now the right target of how far down we need to come is at least 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. So is there any good news on the horizon? When we look at the very small window that remains for action after decades of delay, it's easy to get discouraged. On the other hand, there's a lot of reason for hope, because we do have already to start up a global process to deal with that kind of timeline. You'd never get people organized in time to have the first meeting. But we've had a lot of meetings. And we have global negotiated frameworks that can work. The United Nations Convention on Climate Change, which Canada signed and ratified back in 1992, was signed and ratified by just about every nation on Earth, all 180 or so countries. And within that, we negotiated the Kyoto Protocol. Yes, it is disgraceful that Canada is the only nation that signed and ratified Kyoto that has repudiated and rejected our own legally binding commitments. So the good news is, we're the only one. The bad news is, the Canadian, the shame of it is unbearable. But most of the European Union, for instance, has met its targets. But a lot of countries involved in Kyoto, and we also explain this really, I hope, clearly in the book, and I hope it creates a consensus that will help in the United States on this issue. We've explained why it was that the first phase of Kyoto, it made sense to say industrialized countries go first. It's going to make it harder to get a lot of developing countries on board because of Canada not acting and because of the U.S. refusing to ratify. But that's the other reason for hope. We now have a government in the United States. President-elect Barack Obama has said that his target is 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. That's the right target. And he said since election, yeah, it's a very good thing. He said since getting elected that he holds to those targets. His short-term targets aren't as good as they should be. They're better than the Canadian targets, but they are at least reducing greenhouse gases rapidly. And that's critical. We'll see what happens at the climate negotiations. I started by saying I'll be seeing Zoe there. They start December 1st and run until December 14th. And those negotiations are basically the second to last stop on the effort to have a treaty that can work, that will take place and come into force the minute that the first phase of Kyoto, which was 2008 to 2012, when that ends, December 31st, 2012, the world community, and by that at this point I mean not just the human community, but all living species on this planet, need a workable agreement that will bring down emissions by 2015. To have that in place, we have to make progress next month in Poznan, and the critical negotiations are Copenhagen next December. Those are critical. And I'm hoping that with the presence of a shift in U.S. politics, it could hardly be a more dramatic shift. There are even rumors that the next head of the Environmental Protection Agency could be Bobby Kennedy Jr. Just think of that. An actual activist environmental lawyer who doesn't like pollution. It will be absolutely a historic moment for us all, and a lot of us have worked with Bobby. But we need to see change in Canada as well. The book is chock-a-block full of good suggestions for what people can do in their own lives, because that also matters. Of global financial meltdown and climate change will be interesting. Certainly, the national news media in this country thinks that a global financial meltdown, and the other parties, as Adrian suggested, think that means you don't have to think about climate now, because we're facing a real issue. Right. And if anyone's looked at Sir Nicholas Stern's report, he's former senior economist to the World Bank, who wrote a massive report for the UK government for for the current Prime Minister of the UK when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown. But Sir Nicholas Stern has pointed out that not acting to avoid these worst-case scenarios of climate threaten the world economy with a $7 trillion hit, which will make the current financial meltdown look rather like a delightful summer afternoon tea party. I mean, this is by far the real issue, the real crisis. Now, fortunately, if we're smart, we, whether we're talking about we Green Party or we community leaders or we talking to friends and neighbors or writing letters to the editor, but certainly Barack Obama's already got this point. If we're smart, we point out that in the face of a global financial meltdown, we need to stimulate our own economies to remain healthy. And to do that, we move to an energy revolution. We move to green energies, renewable energies, we move to green collar jobs, we move to all those wonderful ways of, in political buzzwords, explaining that in the current climate, we go off fossil fuels as quickly as possible. And we do it in a way that actually helps the economy get back on track. Because standing still and quivering in a corner and watching RRSPs and investments go down and not buying anything and not having jobs and just driving around in a frantic despair in our SUVs is not going to get us to a healthier economy or respond to the climate crisis. Doing both at the same time could. So that's the kind of message that we'll try to keep taking forward. That's what I'll be trying to do in COSMIN. I want to take questions and discuss anything you want to discuss. And after that, Adrian's going to talk again. And then I'm going to make a beeline to the table so I can sign your book. So I'm going to apologize now because there's going to be a moment when I feel rude because someone's going to be standing here to talk to me and I'm going to be saying, I'm there, over there. So I'm going to find that now so I can make a beeline to that table and then not keep people waiting too long who want to have this as a lovely and thoughtful Christmas present personally inscribed to a loved one of your choice. So,